Good morning, Grid Connections listeners. Thank you for your patience on this kind of last 2 week hiatus. In full disclosure, I just started a new job at a flight school in Central Oregon, and it has caused me to be able to have some challenges with recording last couple of weeks. And I'm hoping moving forward there won't be as many delays, but just full disclosure, that may happen in the future again. But today I'm joined by Steve Burkett. He's an EV educator and the founder of Plug and Play EV. He shares with us his experience on electric vehicles, especially kind of living in the Boston area and how dealing with sometimes the winter and cold of Northeast US can be a challenge for EVs, and how he's been able to really excel and make it easier and educate others about the advantages of actually still being able to go to an electric vehicle, even in the cold, and try to get over a lot of those misperceptions. I do also want to share that if you're listening today on Wednesday, April 10th, I'll actually be going live today at 5 p.m. Pacific on his YouTube channel, Plug and Play EV, where I'll be discussing road tripping in an EV. So definitely going to be a great episode. Really recommend you check that out, and would love to kind of get any feedback and thoughts for being on other channels as well. Which reminds me, I want to say thank you for all of the great suggestions for having people on our show that you've sent to us. One thing worth noting, though, if you can also occasionally reach out to these people that you're trying to get on the show, it does help and it makes it easier for us to get them on. But really looking forward to some of the upcoming episodes that we're working on. And so I just want to say with that, enjoy. So thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you, Chase. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, for anyone who might not be familiar, can you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing and then also your company?
Sure. So I'm relatively new as a EV business, I guess, but a long-time EV driver. So had about 7 or 8 years now driving electric, but kind of came into the business side of it as an EV content creator and educator, I guess, about 6-7 months ago. So Plug and Play EV is started live as a YouTube channel, just trying to kind of bring the adventures of a lonely or adventurous, depending on how you think about it, Bolt EV driver in the Northeast, heading across various trips. But that kind of evolved into a YouTube channel that's got a nice little following now and has slowly moved into becoming kind of a marketer and content creator in the EV space. So I always try and put myself as an educator first and business second, but the two align quite well.
So, I mean, yeah, a Bolt driver, there's, especially in the Northeast with the different weather and a lot of the challenges you get up there, is there anything you can share maybe just as a story that makes you a little stand out, or a time that just you felt like being an EV driver, whether it was the infrastructure or the car that really kind of tested your mettle?
All of it, really. I mean, well, so the Bolt's been a very solid EV. I'd never do it down. It has its obvious kind of limitations on the fast charging side, because it's 4 or 5 times slower than some of the more modern cars. But I mean, initially the channel kind of started out of I wasn't even sure if it really needed a channel, because there were some really good Bolt EV content creators. Eric Way of the News Coulomb channel out on the West Coast was doing a great job from California. But I started to realize that, you know, charging wasn't, as we all know now, charging wasn't particularly great in the winter, you know, the cold of the Northeast. It's not as bad as maybe Canada or the kind of Minnesota type winters, but it still affects charging. And I didn't see any videos out there, any content on that. So I started to kind of just film the sessions, figure out what I was doing, and thought, well, maybe that needs to be shared with other Northeast Bolt owners. And it kind of grew from that nucleus. But yeah, charging infrastructure has been a big one since day one. Obviously, it's, you know, night and day difference now, but certainly still has a ways to go in terms of reliability and coverage in some areas. But yeah, just really starting to try and get that information out there from day one as a Bolt EV owner, to figure out how we use these cars and what we need to do to make the infrastructure better.
Yeah, that's great. I know the Bolts are pretty popular. I'm just curious. I haven't heard as many people driving them in the cold. And so have there been any challenges that you've had around just making sure that the thermals and kind of road tripping, or do you see a pretty big hit when doing a road trip?
Yeah, you don't really get much control over the Bolt's battery. Obviously, you need that heating and cooling element, heating in the winter, of course, to really warm up for fast charging. It was never that much of a fast charger anyway, because it will top out at about 55 kilowatts, which today seems just, you know, glacial. But previously that was pretty good. There wasn't that much equipment that would max it out in those first couple of years of ownership. But really, it's just that kind of range here. It's still, you know, where we would get 250, 260 miles on average in the kind of warmer months, as it drops down in New England. And I'm in Greater Boston, so it's not exactly frigid, but it is, you know, below freezing often enough.
For sure.
And then you're getting charging rates that are maybe in half, and the mileage kind of gets down to that 180, 170 kind of miles. So it's just about really knowing what your, you know, long trips can then start to drag a little bit because you've got the hit of range, you've got the hit of slower charging, and that starts to get into a little bit of, you know, a drag. But there's only so many road trips I think you want to take in the winter, right? So maybe Thanksgiving down to grandma's
Sure.
house, Christmas, that kind of thing. But January, February, March, we didn't typically do a lot of road trips. So really only those 2 months of kind of the holidays were the real kind of killers.
Yeah, and so I appreciate you sharing that with me. From we talk about being an EV educator, and for those who are listening, I'm sure that's something a lot of people who would want to know more or kind of see some of the stuff that you're doing. And as I mentioned, you have your YouTube video, but can you share some other kind of examples of things that you do and offer to kind of help others learn more about electric vehicles?
Yeah, so I've got a long background in content marketing, so I've kind of always appreciated that using information to, you know, share services. So a lot of folks who are new to the EV business world are also very good educators or could be very good educators. So the goal is really to take what, you know, those folks do, whether it's myself, other companies, and just figure out how they can translate that into information that connects with the consumers, the people who are using the cars day to day. So that could be dealerships who have, you know, little, not very much experience in the EV side, and figuring out how to best kind of communicate and package that content to educate their potential buyers. Could be the YouTube sort of kind of side of things, videos, whether it's X, LinkedIn, you know, there's a bunch of platforms, but really it's about figuring out what the potential information provider can give to folks, and then packaging it in a way that they can find it and consume it, you know, in a the right kind of length and something that's right for them.
Yeah, so I'm kind of curious, since you've been doing this now for a while, what are some of the are there any trends that you've seen about like, well, a lot of people used to ask about this or had these misperceptions and that started to change. Is that
Yeah.
something you're seeing?
It's almost reverted. It's strange. It's, you know, there's
Okay.
the first wave of folks were very obviously early adopters, and a lot of people did their homework, you know, way more than the dealers and people they may go to seek help from. So they, that first group of people, yourself, myself, and a bunch of others, kind of went in knowing what we needed to know, or and probably a lot more that we didn't. But then the next wave has kind of, it's starting to hit the, not the mainstream exactly, but we're on that kind of tipping point, right? So again, you've got now a little pushback against EVs. So you're seeing some of the same kind of conversations you had for people who were enthusiastic about electric vehicles, but maybe had some questions about, you know, as you said, range in winter, how they perform on long trips, that kind of thing, and where to charge them, of course. That's coming back, and part of it is because of the kind of media. It's coverage that is not always negative, but there's certainly a kind of hint of, you know, will these work? Will they destroy the grid? Will they, you know, run out of juice on the side of the road? And none of that really happens to the everyday, you know, early adopter, certainly. And the infrastructure is getting so much better that really those kind of range concerns aren't that much of a real world problem. But the media perception is one that, you know, you have to kind of constantly morph and explain why. Some things are valid, you know, people need to know what range they'll get, what kind of charging speeds, how many times they're going to stop. But realistically, you're not going to run out on the side of the road unless you're in a very unplanned road trip in the middle of the Great Plains, maybe.
Yeah, and it definitely does seem like obviously there's the narrative and a little bit of the clicks that drives from that. But it does seem like there's almost a lag in the perception because in some ways, like especially around the charging stuff, a couple of years ago, yeah, it was pretty bad. And even like 18 months ago, it was pretty bad. And now it's definitely gotten a lot better and a lot smoother. And it's just interesting that now within the last 6 months, you're starting to see these stories. So it just seems like it was kind of lagging some of the perceptions and the facts of what was actually happening. And my apologies, my dog is in the room and I think he's just leaving. So if you hear the noises, that's what it is. But talking about that and kind of looking at that, what do you think are some of the areas that when you have these conversations, what are some of the things that when you talk with the person that they're like, oh, I never thought about that. And that kind of then reframes the conversation and starts to kind of get them excited or much more optimistic and start to see like, oh yeah, going to an EV, it really isn't a change. And actually it's a benefit for me.
I think the biggest thing is the gap between, when they'll need to refuel and how, because the biggest focus is always on road trips, especially in North America. You have big, vast distances to cover. Those trips that people make once or twice a year become the first thing they think about. So you have a range of 250, 300 miles, although there are, EVs that do much more than that now, but that's kind of the typical spot at the moment. People think, well, my family's house is 400 miles away, so I don't know the first thing about how to get there. So that's fine, and that's a trip to plan for. Certainly, it's good that they're thinking about that. But what they don't think about, perhaps, is the other 50 weeks of the year when they're not making those trips. And, a lot of people can charge in their driveway or at home. Obviously, there's different use case scenarios for different residential areas, but two-thirds of the country, most of the people that are going to consider an EV at the moment can charge at home and get that benefit of, one-time installation of a home charger. It's not generally that expensive. Sometimes you can do it off the existing connections, depending on your home situation and how old the home is. But really the, how much benefit they're going to get from that to wait, like my car's ready to go now. It's a 90% sitting there, just ready to leave the house because I charged last night. So you're cutting out that weekly gas errand. And most people don't think about that because it's just part of their lives now. They just stop for that 5-10 minutes. But sometimes it's a dedicated errand. Sometimes you wake up for the school run and you haven't, person who had it the previous day didn't fill it up. And that's something you're cutting out of your weekly day-to-day life, which is, most of the time, most of the year, rather than this one trip that kind of people fixate on that they will have to figure out charging.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that because I find like when I talk to people about that kind of road trip misperception, I think the logic and the concern behind it is understandable, but it's kind of funny. Admittedly, I'm kind of one of the few people that does do road trips and actually fairly frequently, but multiple times I've done about 1,200 miles in a day in an EV, and I've done it in a gas car too. And when people hear that, they're like, oh, so it is even possible. But then I've just also found, right or wrong, I started like asking people and kind of pushing them on it, like the last time they've gone on a road trip. And for most people, it's not even like once a year. It has either been multiple years or they're like, well, I guess I never really have. I usually fly.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's a distance, right, of how much would you drive? A lot of people do like to drive, and that's great. But if you like to drive, you'll probably like the EV side because you get to have those nice stops every 200, 300 miles, depending on your range. But if it gets to that kind of, as you're talking about, if you're getting to four digits of driving, multiple days trips, and at that point, the time concern really goes out the window because the flying part of it, unless you really have a lot of stuff to move, and it goes out the window. So I never dismiss the long trip concern, but it definitely takes up most of the oxygen in the room when the local day-to-day driving and how much driving you actually do doesn't seem to register with people,
No, I totally agree. I just think it's been interesting when I've started really talking to people. It just seems like more and more I've pushed people on that and they're like, yeah, I guess I really don't do those anymore. And I think that just is something they can keep hearing. And and once again, I don't want to say people don't do that. I know plenty of people who do, but it's just shocking to me, even over like the last 5 or 6 years when I've started like really talking to people about that more. And they're like, yeah, I guess I've maybe only ever driven 400 to 500 miles in a day.
Yeah,
and then I'm kind of into the rare thing where I'll do 1,000. It's a long day, but even with an EV, it does add time. But if you're smart about it, it's really not as big of a difference. And like you said, it's kind of nice actually every hour and a half to 2 hours just to kind of get out for like 10, 15 minutes, walk around, stretch. And kind of a good mental reboot.
Stop on a road trip, right? There are natural limitations just to the human part. Whether it's the car will keep going, but the human has to stop, stretch, eat, all the rest of it.
Exactly, and I've definitely run into those. And I think that's where you just have to be smart about it and try just to figure out where you want to make those stops, or if you decide you need to stop sooner. That's kind of where it's important to have not only just working charging infrastructure, but like a car with a really reliable nav system where you can say, okay, yep, this works. Hopping out,
And that's what's changing, right? It's
exactly.
Previously, we would make these road trips around the charger. You know, wouldn't really gloss over that. It was, we had to stop where the charger was. So that I quite often go from New York to Ohio, and that's a fairly well-covered route now. We see that changing every time we go across. Now you could stop at these brand-new throughway plazas that have 4, 6, 8 chargers, and you know, there's Tesla ones as well, pretty close. There's, you know, regular non-Tesla connectors as well, so you've got the options there now. But that wasn't the case, you know, even as you said, you know, 18 months, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, certainly there was much more organization around where the chargers were than now, when you can start to get off the, you know, most of these service plazas, at least along the routes that I travel.
Yeah, and I think there's quite a few trips I've done kind of through the Midwest, and that is where you might get a little bit more challenging. But like you're saying, it's becoming more common to find these things. The actual infrastructure itself has been more reliable for me, at least. Yeah, and then the documentation, just even if it's not the car, just even the amount of apps now that are pretty effective for planning and finding these stops has made it a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of, that's what's going to keep changing, right? The big focus in the middle of the country is really building out those travel corridors with the funding that's going through at the moment. So if you look at the amount of, it changes every week, but it was about, last time I checked, 56-57% of that funding has gone to gas stations and truck stops, because that's where those, you know, when you think about what's off an exit at most of these places on travel routes, that's what's there. So a lot of these Loves, Flying J, you know, Travel Centers of America, all of those seem to be getting quite a lot of funding to put these things in, so that people really don't have to think about it that much anymore.
Yeah, and I think that is an area that's kind of, especially I've noticed with a lot of the public, traditional public fast chargers, really struggled with putting in some of these fast chargers. We're always sometimes actually fairly far off the road, especially if you're like on a highway or interstate and you really have to do a detour. And it's really kind of good to see whether some of that's the traditional fast chargers, but it does seem like more just the actual traditional gas stations and large companies are like the Pilots and the Flying J's of the world. They're actually making the investments themselves. And so I think, once again, just the more visibility people see of electric vehicle chargers, the more they realize it's a actual possibility and the less of a change it is to what they are now. Because I think having to drive like 10 minutes off the highway to go find and park in a Walmart definitely isn't the most ideal experience for a lot of people. And there being now enough EVs on the road and interest around in general, that competition is forming and really pushing the traditional, fueling stations and those others in the space to really either have to get their heck together or just actually figure out a way to stay competitive. But I guess that kind of brings up one of the things I know you wanted to talk about a little bit today, was just around NEVI funding. So I'd really love to kind of get your thoughts on it. We've definitely had a few guests on the past that have shared kind of updates around it, but I would really love to hear what you've been seeing and what you want to discuss with us today, Steve.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that the Northeast has received the most NEVI sites at the moment, at least the ones that are energized. It's still in the single digits, but we have a few in New York that have received some funding. The first Tesla federally funded Tesla site went live last week, I think, in Maine, which is a visit I have to plan at some point as the weather improves. I think the first in the nation was Ohio, then we went Pennsylvania, right. There's one out in Hawaii. So you're starting to see a little spread. Obviously, these are very different locations. Traveling in Hawaii in an EV is probably a little easier than maybe the up in Maine. But, you know, the biggest piece is, I think, that these are starting to make other networks, maybe outside of Tesla and Electrify America, which were kind of the first two to cross the country and make a strategic nationwide network for all of their, you know, limitations, perhaps, in Electrify America. The one thing they did do is build out a very large nationwide network across 2 or 3 routes fairly quickly. And what you're trying to see the NEVI funding doing initially is filling in those gaps and say, you know, for every 50 miles of interstate along these alternative fuel corridors that have been designated in each state, we want to fill those so that they have exactly what we've just talked about, these locations within a mile of the interstate exit, and somewhere that even if one is busy, you can roll onto the next one and know that you're going to be good to fill up your EV. So I think it's interesting that that has kind of driven a lot of these states, and you see the gaps in preparation now because, you know, states like New York and Ohio, which had a previous plan, they were already working on this as a at the state level, whether it was through power authorities or departments of transport. They've started to say, right, well, we've got this map, existing map that we wanted to fill. Now we've got federal funds coming in to help us, and they can start to drop the pins in places that they really need to fill in those gaps. Other states are just scrambling and on the back foot to be like, I don't know where to put these things. We've never been through the process of siting looking at a map, figuring out where the power is, trying to contact the right site hosts, all of this stuff that goes into the long, long process of getting a charger in the ground, which I don't think people appreciate can be, 18 to 24 months is quite reasonable for that, from an initial conception to actually energizing a site. So there's a lot of work that goes into it, and I think the states that are leading that, you can see that they've had some kind of planning ahead of time. But it, the end result is going to be the country, if the states get their plans in place, covered with at least four chargers of 150 kilowatts or more, and having that capability to just roll off the site, roll off the interstate, keep going once you've done your whatever you do on a rest stop.
Yeah, I think it's great to finally see some of those funds turn from just kind of projects and announcements to actually things people can go and use, and kind of hope to see that accelerate further. I know some of the states have kind of been slow to adopt it, and some of that also has just been d due to all sorts of changes along the way. Not just obviously part of that is an announcements by automakers kind of moving towards the North American charging standard, but it also just seemed like there was a lot of questions even around how to define and read and what some of these requirements actually stood for. I know kind of a big one was the variance in voltage, and now we're finally seeing a lot of this alignment happen. And now that these projects are on the ground, I'm hoping that for those states who have kind of been laggards or just kind of waiting to have the more clarity, that now that they're seeing that the funds are being made, this isn't being kind of on hold, it'll be kind of what gets the momentum for these other states to get their projects online as well. Because yeah, there's quite a few. I know Wyoming is one, and there's a couple other states where more charging infrastructure on the interstate would be awesome. And they have been lagging a little bit with that implementation.
Yeah, there's certainly some of those states that really could have benefited from it. It's not, it seems to be a political divide thing sometimes, but you certainly got, your Ohio's and Texas seem to be trying to forge ahead. And about half the states, pretty close to half of the states now have, announced some kind of funding. And usually when they announce the first round of awards, that means sites, they actually identify where the sites are going to be. So that is pretty. Then you're just into the construction phase, which is, depending on the location, kind of, it could be 50, 60 days, or, on the upper end, closer to 3 months. But it's fairly quick turnaround. That's where you'll start to see a bunch of these rolling in. The initial, chagrin has been that it's been 2 years or 2+ years since the legislation was announced, and they really, how does it take this long? Well, probably 3/4 of that was just the plans, getting the plans in place. So you see the early states starting to move, and as you said, I think there's going to be a little bit of neighborly rivalry of my next door neighbor now. They've once EV has hit that kind of tipping point at the mainstream, people will be saying, why is that state so good, well covered, and why can't I drive, down the road to my local kind of family in West Virginia or your Wyoming or any of these places that have kind of left things a little bit late.
Yeah, it's also been really interesting looking at you talk about some of the delays, and I think for the NEVI funds and some of the IRA funds, a large part of that was the actual kind of definition and getting that clarity around what these will be. But I think one of the common things I hear from people who are a little confused as to like announcements around charging and even when it's not NEVI as to why it takes so long is just the implementation and what needs to be done from the utility side. I think even the other day, Tesla's kind of been famous for that they've now been building their charging sites almost essentially prefab, and then they just almost just drop ship them and it's ready to go. And they just said they set a new record with like doing that in 4 days. And so I think a lot of people see that 4 day, like, oh my God, this is great. This is going to make it so these can be done all the time. I might be able to go one place and then next week there's a actual site live. And is that possible? Sure. But I think the biggest challenge that's been facing getting more in the ground outside of even that funding, that's in some ways it slowed a couple things down, but now we're kind of just seeing that more cohesive building of it has really been around the permitting and getting the work from the utility and trying to get that moving faster, because that alone to itself can sometimes mean a site takes up to a year to get approved, or getting the new transformers or other site improvements that need to be done actually by the utility before the charge point provider even shows up and puts something in the ground. So I'm curious if there's any thoughts you have around that, or if you've, as an EV educator, worked with any utilities to kind of help them highlight ways that they could be doing this better, or just kind of educating them around the process and seeing if there's ways they can kind of speed up that.
Yeah, I haven't worked with anyone specifically on the process itself, but certainly the communicating out, you know, where they're going and how these sites are going in is a big piece of it. So I was down in the New York International Auto Show last week with the New York Power, week before now, with the New York Power Authority, and that was really insightful to hear, like, what their challenges have been, because they've been through it. As I say, they were doing this 2 or 3 years before the funding was really there, because they saw the need to build this stuff out. And we're literally the day after the eclipse here, and a lot of those sites that they had the foresight to put in that weren't along these major, you know, east-west routes, which is typically commonly what you've seen in other states, they've built out into these more remote areas like the Adirondacks, which got up to the New York and Canada border, down in the southern tier of the state, which is kind of mid-state, I guess. So a lot of these places that, you know, people want to access in an EV in a relatively high adoption state, those authorities knowing that they needed to put that in was a big piece of it. Then you obviously have to communicate out where these things are, how people can use it. So there's the piece of the auto show was a very large booth, you know, by the EV test track, fittingly. So they could hear, you know, EVs, they could go and have a really, in, you know, exciting test drive, get all the kind of bums in seats part of the EV adoption piece kind of checked off, and then come over to this booth and see, right, on a practical level, how do I charge the thing? You know, yeah, I know it's fun. Yeah, I know I like the vehicle, but to your point, you know, where is the infrastructure? Is it looking good near my house? Is it looking good 200 miles from my house? You know, so for New York State specifically, stuff like the Chargeway beacon that they use, which is an app that, you know, you can have on your phone, but it's like a very big kind of kiosk version of that app. So people can literally stand by the, you know, map and then move around with an interactive piece to see how and where they can charge their vehicle in their state and beyond, plan road trips, that kind of thing. So getting those kind of marketing assets out there is really, really valuable, because that's much more of an interactive piece, right? So someone can tell you the vehicle has 300 miles and that's great. But then when you look at a road trip planner and see, right, this is what that road trip of 500, 600 miles looks like, that's quite a big educational piece of getting people confident that they can make this work for them.
Yeah, definitely. And that's great to hear that the Chargeway had one of their beacons there. We've actually had Matt on the show before a couple times, and definitely big fans of what they're doing, trying to help around that education, make the charging and a lot of that a lot simpler for people. I'm curious, being at the auto show, were there any things that you, I guess, one, were there any EVs or other new cars that you saw that you liked? But I'm curious if there was any other just kind of interesting trends you were seeing in general, since you had both combustion, electric vehicles, and I guess also hybrids there as well.
Yeah, hybridization is a big piece for some of them. Obviously, Toyota, you know, will always lead that kind of side of things, and they always have a massive, massive booth. A lot of these things was Electrify Expo in New York a couple of years ago. Mm. They had pretty large showing, but just in general, as I've, you know, I kind of go dip in and out of auto shows, but I'm certainly seeing a lot more EVs on the floor. I think it was somewhere between 40 and 50 electric vehicles that were on show, which previously would have been maybe 5 to 10. The big reveals were actually, you know, for most of the brands seemed to be either plug-in hybrids or, you know, a new version of something that they had previously produced, which was combustion. So maybe the big reveals weren't electric this year. But we had Polestar 4 was unveiled there, and they showed the North American version, the pricing. So Polestar CEO Thomas Ingelath was, you know, there on site to kind of push EVs. And obviously Polestar as an EV-only brand is going to, you know, take a lot of attention for electric vehicles. Kia EV9 won a couple of awards, not just the World Electric Car of the Year, but also the World Car of the Year. Hyundai Ioniq 5N won the performance car of the year, which I know put a few noses out of joint, I think, for people who want to hear a roar of an engine when they're performance vehicles. But just
Sure.
generally, every automaker, even GM, which in the past has disappointed me because they kind of, they had a lot of Ultium promises, but only really the next gen vehicles weren't really on display, weren't delivered. We had the Silverado EV, Blazer EV, Equinox EV. So I start to get to a point where I can't remember all the models. That's a good sign that the automaker's doing a good job.
And then with that, I mean, there were obviously a lot of people there. I'm kind of just curious what the big thing has always been talked about, and I have found it effective, just getting kind of butts in seats and people driving cars. I'm just curious if there were any other things that you've seen that's really effective to get people kind of over that initial hump or kind of confusion around EV, and just what you found as far as maybe just the tone and thoughts from people at a, I just feel like auto shows, they've been struggling honestly for a long time, and especially since COVID. And so I'm just kind of curious if you saw a lot of just normal people going there to check out cars in general, or was it more of a press announcements with a personal connection, a part to it? I'm just kind of curious to learn a bit more about the tone and
Well, I was
anything that
definitely
stood out to
skinny
you.
because I went on the media day, so I really only saw the people. They were doing their unveils, so it was much more of a kind of big splash trying to make headlines, that kind of thing. So you got some of the flavor, but most of these people are inside baseball. They know, they're either pro EV, maybe not so much for EV, but whatever they were, they knew their stuff. Day to day, I think, you're right on auto shows in general. I think there's a lot less buzz around them than there used to be. There still were some decent announcements, but it's not what it was in terms of this is where everything will happen. I think you're seeing, like, for example, Tesla wasn't there, so immediately that's more than half of the EV market in the United States not covered. Although I think they did then a couple of days later, they must have known that there was a crowd in town because they were in town with a Cybertruck dragging around a Tesla Model Y in a glass case around Manhattan. So there's definitely some activity around that. Rivian, actually, down in their showroom down there in the Meatpacking District, had the R2 on display. I don't know if the R3 was there. I didn't get a chance to go down. But so I think you're seeing around when there are these big events and they know people are in town, they will put events around it, but they're not the newer automakers, the new EV only automakers, other than Polestar, were trying to find other ways to do these big reveals rather than the traditional auto show. And as far as people go, I think it's still a nice family event. I think if you can go out and spend an hour or two, looking at the cool cars, that's great. But I think for pure EV adoption, you're probably looking at more of these, like the month we're in right now is Drive Electric Earth Month, right? Stuff like that, the kind of grassroots level, people being able to go to these events and have an actual test drive, because even the test drives weren't really, they were ride-alongs at the auto show rather than actual test drives. So stuff like Electrify Expo, which is in a bunch of different cities this year, those have actual test drives and slightly bigger tracks. And if you go to these events that are, just EV owners taking their vehicles because they're early adopters and they kind of, want to show them off, you get a lot more of these kind of real world stories, I think. So they'll tell you, most EV owners aren't shy about saying this journey was a nightmare, this was perfect. These are the ones that, this is where it's gonna
Learn
how
from my
it's gonna be.
mistakes, kind
Pretty
of a
much,
thing.
yeah. And I think that's kind of that EV educator piece again, right? It's not really this isn't a particularly old industry if you take it as the modern kind of mile marker, starting with the Nissan Leaf and then the Tesla Model S. And for 5 years we really didn't have that much activity. I didn't come into it until that Bolt kind of 2016, 2017 point. So it's not very long in the tooth, this industry. There's a lot of stuff to learn still, and it's all changing. Every month there's something new happening in charging, in the models, in the technology most months. So you really just have to stay on top of it and then pass that knowledge on to people who are coming into it just from a complete blank slate, I think.
I think that's some great points about just it seems to be most effective and driven when it is more of a grassroots thing by current owners. I do want to take one step back though, because you mentioned something that kind of was interesting around like how Tesla and Rivian, more of the, I mean, I don't think you really call Tesla a startup anymore, but they've always had definitely kind of at least a startup mentality in their business approach. And so I was just curious when you see I think it kind of goes back to what I was asking earlier about just like the current state of auto shows. And it's a very interesting to see that and Rivian doing their own things, taking advantage of some of the buzz of being in town and people there, but also just kind of like, yeah, we're going to do our own thing instead of having to pay for it. Is that, I'm just kind of curious of your thoughts of that strategy, because obviously we're talking about it. It is creating buzz. And I had seen some headlines. I had been kind of busy, so I hadn't really fully appreciated that those were all both around the time of the New York Auto Show. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of curious on your thoughts if those are the ways that maybe more traditional auto companies need to start thinking more to really be positioning EVs to kind of stand out and do things that are a bit different to get that interest.
I think so. I mean, it's, you know, from a broader marketing perspective, you know, you either put your marketing kind of efforts into somebody else's hands with an auto show to an extent. I mean, obviously you have the design and the creative, but you're also putting yourself into a very loud environment. So yes, sure, you can probably come out and maybe that's part of the awards. You know, I mean, I don't know how much people really put stock in these awards, but they certainly, you know, the manufacturers will make big noise about these things. But it's only one piece of maybe 4, 5, 6 other automakers with big announcements. So you're competing for that attention. And there's only so much writing and so many articles that people can put out, right? So Rivian having a presence in New York for that was smart. But then they did the big reveal for the R2 and the R3. I think it was probably 3 or 4 weeks before. And right, that took all the attention. I mean, obviously we're in the EV bubble. We hear all of this stuff anyway. It's never going to pass us by. But they certainly, you know, for the size of the company and how much presence they, you know, don't have a massive presence in the US just yet. But that took a lot of attention. You know, it's the R2 being in a relatively affordable, you know, family SUV and not being launched at one of the biggest auto shows in the country at the time of its launch, you know, is notable. And I think they get to define that then. They get to own that experience. They chose the location in Laguna Beach. They're trying to push this kind of, you know, adventure or kind of outdoorsy family adventure brand vibe. And you can still do that. You know, Subaru is a good kind of contrast because they have that and they'd always have a really good booth.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
An experience, and they define that. So they're only a piece of the wider show in that, whereas Rivian completely owned the you know, the launch of that. And I think you go back and see a traditional automaker doing it. The ID Buzz is a good example, right? They did the kind of Surfside, California, you know, thing to kind of launch the ID Buzz, you know, give it that brand value for the surfing kind of beachside atmosphere. And you wouldn't get that as an auto show, or if you did, it would be very kind of fake and artificial. So I think that real world, define it, choose your timing, you know, do it on your terms is going to be valuable and an EV is a chance to do that. You know, it's a chance to reinvent how you do the vehicle, certainly, but also how you market, how you sell to people. So I think it's an interesting way to kind of change things up and maybe ditch some of the original things that worked in the past but are kind of going by the wayside now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting when you using the example of Rivian, just looking at kind of the I think it's interesting everything you just said, but specifically when you reference Subaru. Mm-hmm. Because I think so much of the buzz in the comment section after the Rivian announcement, like, oh, this is going to kill Tesla, or this is going to sell millions and millions of copies, which who knows, it might. It looks like actually a pretty awesome car. I know a couple of people who've already put down reservations for it. But I think in practice, once you actually get into reality and out of the comment section online, I think what you said about Subaru is really interesting and pretty accurate. As someone who's owned a couple of Subarus and know plenty of people that still do, like I know some people who went to Tesla, but in a lot of ways it's a different kind of psychographic, if you want to look at it, as for like the buyer and stuff, and there really hasn't been as great of a focus or niche for that kind of lifestyle or building those products, especially in that price point. And so while I think a lot of media narrative and the comment section is always talking about, oh, this is going to, it's either Rivian versus Tesla, which I don't think it is at all. It, to me, it's more like if you're a legacy automaker, especially like a Subaru, who has had a niche, but overall is actually pretty small volume in the U.S., but it's one of their larger markets still as an automaker. That's really the concern, is to see a brand like Rivian that's getting those people that have been kind of your tried and true so excited about EVs and so excited about a new product that really is focused on them, that it's just been interesting to see that with the other. You can kind of say that with Tesla when they first got in the space around the traditional premium European automakers. And now they've even kind of come down a little bit. I would still say it's a premium car in a lot of ways. Their price point and what they offer kind of makes them competitive with like a Honda and Toyota and their volumes and as well. And so I'm curious if there's anything that you've been seeing that the way that the new EV startups or startup mentality has been pushing automakers, and why you don't think that there has been more concern or outward expression by like the legacy automakers, especially if you're the CEO of Subaru. What are you doing after the R2 was just announced? Because I mean, I think to me that is a pretty serious long-term risk to them as a company.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the long term versus short term, right? Because I think right. You're still going to sell a lot more Toyotas than you are Rivians or Subarus even than you are Rivians. But that brand loyalty only goes so far. I think you do see translate a little bit. That's why stuff like the BZ4X from Toyota and the Subaru Solterra will sell, even though they're not particularly great EVs from a nerd kind of point of view. Don't charge fast, don't really do anything that special. There's a brand loyalty that will extend a little bit. But you're right, long term, I mean, these are, you know, Rivian is a brand that is forging it. It's really, really well done. And, you know, everything they put together is well crafted as an outdoors package, so that, you know, it's not just the R2 that they launch, it's a tent, right. That, you know, and whether it comes to fruition right. or not is another thing, because everybody wanted their camp kitchen for the R1T, but that doesn't seem to be coming. But, you know, it's still, they have accessories, they are kind of geared to putting together an ecosystem. So, I mean, I think the other side of it that is maybe pushing traditional automakers is software. And leading with that kind of piece of, you know, the car will do a lot of the work for you, or the infotainment and the software regularly updating itself, having a vehicle in the driveway that is not going old by the model year. You know, it's getting updated as you go. I think you see a little bit of that with Ford. They've probably been the most prominent US automaker, at least, that has kind of started to drop a lot of updates. You know, there's a lot of power-ups that come through, and they've led, obviously, with the transition to NACS with the adapter. Part of that is software as well. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. Yeah. You know, people couldn't get their vehicle charging on you know, Tesla superchargers, even if they had the adapter, without that software update. So you have to have that system in place. And it's not trivial. You know, Tesla has been building this for years and has just led with it as a software first kind of company. Rivian is taking that to a similar kind of level for the outdoors stuff and tweaking your vehicle for, you know, being able to adjust ride height, auto leveling for towing, all these kind of things that, you know, maybe, you know, manual before. You're starting to see them come as not just software that comes with the vehicle, but software updates over the air. And I think that's challenging a lot of the traditional automakers, certainly iDriver, Hyundai Ioniq 5, and it's night and day difference. I do get over the air updates, which was a step up on my Bolt EV, but they are once every half a year, I think, and usually it's something like the icons change and I get a new map interface or something, whereas, you know, other manufacturers are EV startups or EV first companies are dropping these things with, you know, all kinds of new features and things that actually affect your ownership experience.
Yeah, I think especially around the conversation with like long term, and when you look at like kind of brand loyalty, that the software is, I think, been kind of the biggest Achilles heel and maybe not fully appreciated. And I think a lot of people even still kind of like, oh yeah, that was cool. We put a lot of money into it, but it's just turned out to be such a big hassle and kind of has now dismissed it. But like you're talking about with Rivian, especially, like, I think that is a huge component. While there is a lot of their marketing and the hardware and the camp kitchen and all these sorts of things that they've kind of tried to put a focus on to even reinforce that alignment, I think the people who actually buy the cars and then that day-to-day experience and become those kind of grassroots and other people like pushing it, the software makes a huge difference in that experience for them to kind of feel like they are having a fine tailored experience, unlike what they would have gotten from driving a Subaru or something. And I think it's just really interesting to me that software is a big component, I think, of that long-term brand loyalty. And I know that me personally, that's been a big thing for me. And especially when you are going, as we started on, like long road trips, like if you're going to, it almost seemed like for a while that you had Tesla, I think Porsche had a little bit, but unfortunately it's not like they're a very accessible EV, but those are two cars that had pretty good route planning. And that is once again, such a big part of the EV experience. And that is driven by software. And so I'm curious to see how, and Rivian obviously has now kind of gone up and they're sending a lot of these updates very frequently. And I do think that when you look at the long-term strategy for these EV focused companies, that is probably going to be the big, one of the big three things that makes them the companies that will be taking so much market share long-term from the traditional companies, is that software that leads to a much more engaging and kind of personalized experience. I'm curious if there's any other things that you've seen that have really impacted the brand loyalty for EVs, or things that have kind of made you either loyal to your Bolt or now kind of more loyal to the Ioniq, as just like far as these kinds of special things that stand out for you.
No, I think actually it's almost the opposite. It's done a kind of reset on brand loyalty for a lot of, at least early adopters. I don't know how the early mainstream will kind of position themselves, but I think it, the reason I chose the Ioniq was purely the new platform, the 800 volt platform and the charging. So it's been, you know, we've gone from 40, 50 minute stops to 20 minute stops for our charging needs. So, you know, it gives a little more flexibility on travel, but I don't think, other than being quite impressed with their EV technology, that Hyundai or Kia or any other kind of loyal customer. And that wasn't, you know, the case. I kind of loved the Bolt, actually. It was a, you know, really good car that I'd happily have again as a kind of second EV. But again, GM has made some missteps. And in terms of the software kind of thing that we're talking about, Hyundai hasn't really pulled up any trees in delivering, you know, regular updates and kind of system. That's probably the weaker part of the car. So I don't think any of them have really, including the new manufacturers. You know, there's Tesla has its following, of course. You know, that's a huge kind of driver in the industry. But even them, I think you're seeing, how do they crack this mainstream? You know, there's a whole pool of people out there who are brand new to electric vehicles, and there are some kind of segments that will stay with a Subaru, that will stay with Toyota because they know it and they have that brand value. But I think it's splintering and fracturing to a point where you say, well, yeah, Toyota can build an excellent, reliable combustion car or a hybrid car, but I think everybody has a track record to create now with electrification. And I think you're seeing brands like Hyundai and Kia trying to kind of reinvent themselves. Like, their design side has gone completely, you know, in the opposite direction, and a lot of really taking advantage of the form factor of EVs, being able to stretch out that wheelbase, make more space inside the car, you know, take away the tunnel. There's a bunch of different things that are kind of going into this transition, and it's an opportunity for a lot of automakers to start to really move. I think what you're seeing, though, is you know, some automakers, traditional automakers, fumble the ball a little bit. Nissan being a good example. You know, we talk about them starting the movement with the Leaf and then just kind of going off on a weird sidetrack, kind of failing to deliver the Nissan Ariya at a time when it would have been pretty good EV, and then launching it at a time when it's basically a, you know, one of many, many crossover SUVs in the market. GM, another good one, you know, came to market pretty before, you know, Tesla, really, with the Model 3. They had the Bolt EV doing that 250, 300 miles, you know, before Tesla had that Model 3. But again, just kind of the switch to Ultium has been really kind of fumbled a little bit. You know, the software side seems to have been a problem. They haven't managed to ramp up production as quickly as they wanted. So then discontinuing the Bolt as a, you know, the most affordable EV on the market, you just see these kind of the missteps that, you know, they could have built, both of these manufacturers, General Motors and Nissan, very different, but they could have built quite a loyal base of EV followers and adoption, and then build from there to prove that they've got the kind of chops to become an EV only, or at least an EV primary manufacturer. But I think it's just a big opportunity for everybody. You know, there's a lot of long way to go. Nobody has really convinced everybody except for Tesla that they can make and market EVs, you know, that are compelling consistently. So it's kind of early days, even though it seems like we've been here for a long time. It's a lot of road ahead of us.
Thank you for joining us today, and a big thank you to Steve for sharing his experience and thoughts on the EV industry with all of us today. I really appreciate everything that people have been doing to send feedback as well as share recommendations for guests on the show. I also hope it wasn't too obvious that I recorded this episode at 5 a.m. my time, but some of these things that we've had to do kind of on the fly with the new job, but hoping to kind of get to more of a rhythm that should make it a lot easier and kind of get back to where we were previous to the little hiatus there. Once again, remember this evening I will be on, and this evening being Wednesday, April 10th, I will be on Steve's podcast as well, talking about EV road tripping at 5 p.m. Pacific. Once again, thank you. And until next time, this is the Grid Connections Podcast signing off.